This program is brought to you by PersonalLifeMedia.com. Welcome to Dishy Mix. I'm your host, Susan Bratton. And on today's show, you're going to get to meet Kevin Ryan. Kevin is the CEO at Motivity Marketing, and he's the advisory board chair at the Search Engine Strategies Conferences, which are run by Incisive Media. He recently had a great run there, kind of reprogramming and revitalizing that whole organization. And you're going to get to find out what Kevin Ryan is going to do now and next. But before we get into that, I want to let you know that every week when you listen to Dishy Mix, you hear about goodies from my guests. My guests come bearing gifts for Dishy Mix listeners. And I have a lot of swag, and I want to give it to you. So let me tell you about some of the stuff that I have for you. I have Dave Evans' new book, Social Media, An Hour a Day. I read it. He's personally autographing copies for Dishy Mix fans. It's really good. And he'll write it, make it out directly to you. And he's coming on the show soon. I've got John Zogby, who gave me some wonderful copies of The Way Will Be, the Zogby Report on the Transformation of the American Dream. Alex Bogusky gave me a couple of copies of Hoopla. That's the book about Crispin Porter and Bogusky. And he gave me some cycling jerseys, some pink Hoopla cycling jerseys. So if you're a bicycler, you might want to snag my swag. Pete Blackshaw, I still have a few copies of Satisfied Customers Tell Three Friends. Angry Customers Tell 3000, Running a Business in Today's Consumer-Generated World. Paul Wilmington came to us with lots of goodies. He's got some Naked Communications books called House of Naked, and he has some Naked on Tour t-shirts, which I think are really well designed. And Gina Bianchini's offered up some Ning emblazoned tchotchkes. Maybe you'd like a Ning coffee cup or some goodie. So take advantage of these. Maybe you're listening and you think, no, the stuff is all gone. I still have a lot of good tchotchkes, and one has your name on it. How do you get it? Just go to my Dishy Mix Facebook fan club. Go to Facebook, search on Dishy Mix, all one word. You'll find my fan club. Just post on my wall there and tell me what you want, and I'll see if I can get it for you. Make it a good post and let me send you something fun. So let's get on with our show, but I wanted to make sure you got access to some major swag. So we're gonna talk with Kevin today, and some of the things we're going to talk about are thuggish anonymity, his Zen approach to life. Apparently, this is newfound. We want to hear about it. We're going to talk about cash multiples, expensive wines, and one of Kevin's passions, motorbikes.
When you get hooked on the startup environment, it's a little like being hooked on crack. You really need it. And the bigger the company becomes, the more corporate it becomes, the more process-oriented it becomes. And for the entrepreneurial people among us, it becomes more difficult to survive in that type of environment. And all these places that I've been in continental Europe and in Asia, it's really given me an interesting perspective on the world. I'm a lot less concerned with getting up and getting known than I am with gaining an understanding of what the wants and needs of the people around the world are, and what the cultural disparities from one market to the next, and how to accommodate them. I can tell you that there are some really exciting areas in the vertical interest categories, like in the area of healthcare and some of the other recreational activities that are really gaining ground and really doing well. Everything we say and do is being placed on sites, social sites like Facebook, MySpace. And in addition to that, we have, the downside of some of these, the vertical sites, is that all of our information is being placed for public consumption. And how much time do we have left to actually really enjoy our lives?
Welcome, Kevin Ryan.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm just sitting here mapping out all of the expertise that Google has lost over the last couple of years and trying to find out where everyone is going.
Oh, right. So you call this the Google diaspora. Is that right?
Actually, it appeared in Esquire magazine last month and just appeared in I saw it in Search Engine Land as well.
And everybody's leaving Google now? They've vested their stock options and they're getting picked off?
You know, it's amazing. I look at the number of people still at Google who have vested.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's really interesting to me what compels them to stick around. There's obviously quite a few people, they named 35 or so in this list, that, you know, have gone on to do something else. These are entrepreneurial people that they have the burning desire to go out and do something different. They miss the startup environment. You know, when you get hooked on the startup environment, it's a little like being hooked on crack. You really need it. And the bigger the company becomes, the more corporate it becomes, the more process-oriented it becomes. And for the entrepreneurial people among us, it becomes more difficult to survive in that type of environment.
Yeah, I know that when we started Personal Life Media, Tim and I, it was our eighth startup between us. So once you're good at that, it's a unique environment and it's a very compelling environment. And so I certainly understand that they're going to lose people. People can't stay at those campuses forever. And those campuses are ginormous. And I'll tell you, if you're over 35, you go there every day, you feel a little old. I mean, it is a lot of kids there now. Don't you think?
It's a lot of kids, and I wonder. I've actually been to more Google offices around the world, but I think than I have been to Incisive offices around the world. And it's just amazing the consistency of the culture at every office, the consistency of the mentality of the people there. It's absolutely impressive, but at the same time overwhelming, and I do feel old.
So you've really, for the last probably almost a year and a half, you've been, I wouldn't call it reinventing SES, but really making a lot of changes. I always had this sense that SES had become a little formulaic. And it seems to me, in looking at the work that you've been doing over the last year and a half, that you've made a lot of changes. I know that now you've kind of segued out of there, you're moving on, and you've got a lot of other things you want to do, which I want to hear about. But just tell me what you think, in your perspective, were the biggest changes or the most impact that you had in your time as really the hands-on person rather than more of the advisory board person for SES.
Well, sure. What was really necessary, I think, from the perspective of the company, was that they desperately needed a restructuring so that the company wasn't so entirely focused on the single point of failure to create a more
horizontal. You mean Dan? Was that Danny Sullivan, the single point of failure?
No, I mean, in Danny's instance, it was a single point of success. I mean, the man created this amazing event series in the portal. But once he was no longer there, the company was in dire need of restructuring, or the event was in dire need of restructuring,
yep.
I think.
I didn't mean that negatively, by the way.
No, I actually very much admire Danny. And, the last time I was out in California, I stopped in to say hello.
Right, he moved back to Orange County, right?
Oh, goodness, yes. He's actually about two or three blocks from New York Talk. Blocks from my old haunt in Newport Beach there.
That's funny. So what were the big changes that you made at SES, or maybe something that you feel like was your most proud mark?
I think, you know, creating the sibling brand or the line extension brand for the Forum of Events in Europe, Western Europe offered a very distinct type of challenge for SES. When most of us think of Europe, or most Americans think of Europe, they think of Europe as one entity, but actually there are, each country has its own unique demands, its own unique culture, and its own unique structure. So it was very important to create geographically relevant and culturally relevant events, and that's what we did with the Forum event series. And also breathe some new life into the U.S. events as well. The U.S. events are absolutely ginormous. And they require a lot of attention. And now with the new competition in the marketplace, challenging dynamics in the world of economics, the world is a different place. So it definitely needed some new thinking, some new thought leadership. And I think that was my biggest contribution.
You spent a year and a half really on the road, going to all of these places. And you said that traveling around the world in this last year has given you a much more Zen approach to life. Tell me how this Zen approach to your life has manifested.
I spent the early part of my career being really edgy and hell-bent for leather on getting successful and getting known and that sort of thing. And over the last year and seeing and spending so much time immersing myself in these cultures, from Tokyo to Paris, to Hamburg, in the UK, and everywhere in between, all these places that I've been in continental Europe and in Asia, it's really given me an interesting perspective on the world. I'm a lot less concerned with getting up and getting known than I am with gaining an understanding of what the wants and needs of the people around the world are and what the cultural disparities from one market to the next and how to accommodate them.
Interesting. That could give you a lot of good opportunity in whatever you do next. And we're going to talk about some of the things you're doing next. But I wanted to go back to a question that I'd asked you in preparing for this. And I asked you what your worst fork in the road bad decision was that you regretted. And you said launching a professional services company, that you didn't structure the company correctly. And no matter what you did, the cash multiples would never be there. You know, you've been in the events business. You've seen that model. You've done the service model apparently incorrectly your first time out of the shoot. What are you going to do with all of this knowledge, and how does it apply to what you're doing now going forward?
So when we talk about professional services companies, no matter what you do, no matter the amount of work and blood, sweat, and tears that you put into these things, it's only going to be worth 2.5 times revenue on a very good day. And at the end of the day, that's an awful lot of work that just won't scale. And I've become more and more excited with a lot of the verticals that are establishing, the vertical interest categories, the vertical interest sites, not unlike sites like Personalized Media, that are doing some amazing things that will scale out to millions of people very, very efficiently. There have been a number of companies that kind of approached me to either sit on their board as an advisor or help them facilitating coming into the market.
So you're thinking maybe more, less of a service, is more of a product, even if it could be a virtual product or an online property, as something that you might like to try next.
Absolutely. And in fact, I mean, there are some of them that I'm doing now. Unfortunately, I can't say which specific companies they are because there are often confidentiality agreements that come along with the type of assistance that I provide. So I can't say which ones, but I can tell you that there are some really exciting areas in the vertical interest categories, like in the area of healthcare and some of the other recreational activities that are really gaining ground and really doing well.
Well, I want to take a break, and when we come back, I want to cover a couple things. I want to know what you mean by thuggish anonymity, because you've coined that term, perhaps, and I want to hear more about that. I want to talk about the digital mafia with you. I want to talk about your book and when it's coming out. I want to hear your perspective on the future of search. I've got a lot of questions. We've got to talk about wine and motorbikes, so we're going to go to a break and thank my sponsors who let me have this time with you. I have some new sponsors too, so I'm hoping that if you're listening to the show, you'll also keep a keen ear for my sponsors. There are some nice offers that people custom create just for Dishy Mix, and I hope they're germane to you. So we're with Kevin Ryan. He's the CEO at Motivity Marketing. I love the name Motivity, Kevin. You did a great job with that. It's a really catchy name. Has a lot of motion, activity. It's really good. I just love it. It's a great sniglet. So we're going to go to a break. And when we come back, we'll talk to Kevin about all kinds of fun things. I'm your host, Susan Bratton. Stay tuned.
Listen to Coaching the Life Coach, business and marketing strategies for growth of transformational practices, your guide in the 21st century marketplace on personallifemedia.com.
We're back, And I'm Susan Bratton. We're with Kevin Ryan, CEO at Motivity Marketing. So, Kevin, tell me what this thing is, thuggish anonymity.
Well, it's a discussion about, Lee Siegel really talked about it in his book, and I asked him to come in and keynote in San Jose. And we just did a fireside chat, and we talked about the world as we know it and the social constructs that exist now on the internet with on the basis of everyone has a voice, everyone has an opportunity to express an opinion, and that's something that we never really had before. And I think Lee may have actually said it, used the term thuggish anonymity. But basically, people feel falsely empowered when they're blogging, when they're anonymous on the web. They can say anything they want, they can do whatever they want, and they don't think about the consequences of their actions and what they're saying and doing, what it actually means. And there's a great deal of them in the search category that care nothing about accuracy, care nothing about the implications of what they're saying, and their primary interest is gaining some link equity, getting a lot of people to link into the site because they've used something that's just absolutely, it's not even thought-provoking, it's just controversy for the sake of controversy.
So I was reading a little bit about this Lee Siegel. I'd like to read an excerpt and then talk about it with you. May I do that?
Sure, yeah.
Okay, so Lee Siegel wrote the book Against the Machine, Being Human in the Age of the Mob. Now, what I'm reading you is an excerpt from a review by Lewis Baird on Salon.com about Lee Siegel's book Against the Machine. He says, Siegel may have liberal credentials, but he is making, at bottom, a conservative argument in favor of gatekeepers and cultural elites against the cacophony of untrammeled opinion. In the same way that Edmund Burke regarded the guillotine in the Place de la Révolution, Siegel regards Gawker and YouTube. And when he writes that the internet is possibly the most radical transformation of private and public life in the history of humankind, he doesn't mean radical in a nice way, any more than Burke did. Bad times are a-brewin. The borders of truth are eroding. Knowledge is devalued into information, and Americans are producing, not enjoying, their own leisure. Our interior lives are being packaged like merchandise, and the sources of critical detachment are drying up as book supplements disappear from newspapers, and what passes for critical thinking in the more intellectually lively magazines gives way to the internet's emphasis on cuteness, novelty, buzz, and pursuit of viral. I loved that. I thought that was very interesting. What struck you about that as you were listening?
Well, I see a lot of people talking about the new social construct, if you will, how we've become detached from our own emotions, and everything that we say and do is now a matter of public discourse.
Right. We're twittering. We're not frittering our lives away. We're twittering our lives away.
We're twittering our lives away. We're stumbling upon things. We have a new annoying Facebook application every day. Everything we say and do is being placed on sites, social sites like Facebook, MySpace. In addition to that, we have, the downside of some of these, the vertical sites, is that all of our information is being placed for public consumption. And how much time do we have left to actually really enjoy our lives is probably something that's entirely separate and a separate discussion.
So let's move right there. I can't resist a fabulous segue. Really enjoying our lives. Let's talk about expensive wine.
Well, good wine does not have to be expensive. Good wine is often expensive,
yeah.
Which is a complication or a byproduct of production, I think, and supply and demand. The combination of the euro's rise over the dollar, along with what's happening with Italian wine producers, they're producing some amazing wine. Gaia, Sassicaia, Taurasi Radici, I mean, some of these labels that people have never heard of and never associated Italian wines with this level of luxury, but their Barolos are just absolutely amazing. Everybody that I know in the wine world is absolutely obsessed with Italian producers right now. In fact, Sergio Esposito he owns the Italian wine merchants brand, just released a book called The Passion on the Vine, which is a great read.
So I have made a change to my consumption of wine recently. I noticed that I'm actually not drinking as much wine as I used to. I'm sure that's a sign of my age. But I also noticed that the $15 and $20 bottles of wine that I would have with dinner weren't satisfying me. I was disappointed continuously. So I decided to try a little experiment, and I said, all right, well, I'm drinking less, so why don't I pay a little more and see if it's worth the money? Now, when I go to the grocery store or the wine shop or wherever I go, and I actually am buying a lot of wine right now because when Tim and I were going to sell our house, we essentially sucked all the wine down out of our wine cellar. We just got rid of it, started drinking it, popped the old stuff because we weren't going to transport it if we were moving our house. So we have nothing left.
I'm really sorry I missed that part.
While you're in like Western Bulgaria, you know, reinventing SES, dude, we were out here in California sucking down some good stuff. But we don't have any wine left. We've got an empty wine refrigerator thing in our kitchen. So I've been buying a lot of wine. Well, I upped it to $20 to $25. Sometimes I'll creep into $30. And I'll tell you that my satisfaction has increased 100% on the wine that I'm consuming now. It's almost like that threshold has really moved up in the last 10 years. There really aren't very many good $15 or even $20 bottles of wine now. And if you're going to pop a bottle of wine, you're actually going to save or something. Throw another 5 or 10 at it. That's my motto. And it's working for me. And this is my daily stuff. That works. That's a price range that I can support and works for me.
I think that's a great philosophy. And I'd even say, I mean, enjoying the wine doesn't mean that you have to be consuming mass quantities of it. There's a lot of great stuff. I think just my personal opinion is that California is a bit overpriced. I think Napa is a little bit in love with itself.
Yeah. And I'm tired of them.
Joseph Phelps Insignia, I'm on, basically, in New York, you have a couple of choices to buy wine, and none of them are inexpensive. So I actually have everything that I'm drinking shipped in from California. There's a huge store, an online store called K&L.
Yeah, I love K&L. K&L Wine Merchants.
It's great stuff. They have some imports coming in from France. The running joke in French wine is that they send the Americans the garbage that they don't want to drink. But K&L actually has some really decent stuff. So I've gone out to all the websites of the producers that I like, and I get their wine club shipments. And October's a fun time to be hanging out with me because all of the producers in California start shipping again. And all the releases come out.
Oh, that's great.
But I do think California's fallen in love with itself just a little bit too much, particularly some of those Napa producers like Phelps. Insignia is not worth $200 a bottle.
No,
sorry.
It's insane. I agree with you. I recently put together an ad program for a lot of the shows on my network. I have a lot of green and sustainable living and what I would call LOHAS-oriented content. You know what LOHAS is? Lifestyles of health and sustainability. So people who want to choose products that are better for them. And I thought, wow, a really good potential product would be organic wine for my listeners. Because I have Living Green and Green Talk Radio and Buddhist Geeks and all kinds of fun shows like that. And so I found the company that had the highest search rankings for organic wine. And it was the organic wine, the French wine company. And they have a URL called ecowine.com. And I was like, oh, sweet. And I actually worked with them to put together a 3-pack of wine, a white, a red, and a sparkler. It's a French brother and sister, and they grow all the grapes on their own property. And it's all organic. And so they put a package together, a 3-bottle pack. I wanted an offer that would be good on my podcasts. So you get a free bottle of wine when you buy the 3-pack. You only pay for 2, and they pay for shipping. And so I'm testing that offer right now. This is a fairly new campaign running through a lot of the different shows on my network. And, you know, testing my assumption, I think consumers would be interested in wines grown in a family vineyard that are organic and get a free bottle of wine. And so I'm trying that out. So just if you want to try it, or anybody who's listening wants to try it too, you can get this too. You don't have to listen to the ad. You just use promo code GREEN when you check out. You just go to ecowine.com and buy the French Bouquet sampler and use promo code GREEN and you'll get your free bottle. And so I've tried that wine. I really like their wines and I like the fact that they're organic. So it's a nice gift. I'm thinking about gifting that over the holidays to people and things like that too. So I'm dabbling in the eco wine world myself, and that's fun.
Yeah, those smaller producers, there's absolutely some amazing stuff coming out of them. There's a producer, I believe it's in Rutherford, which is part of Napa, correct?
Yeah, it is.
Called Lewis Cellars, and they produce every year a Bordeaux blend called Alex Blend.
Okay.
Alex Blend. And it's just absolutely amazing, and it's not ridiculously expensive. It's probably $50 or $60 a bottle.
Well, what I'll do is I'll make sure I put a link to that in the episode description of this show, so anybody who's listening and they're on their airplane or whatever, we can just come back and find it. So I'll do that. Before we end the show, one of the things that I want to make sure I do is tap your intelligence on the future of search. Now that you've been all over the world and you've visited every Google HQ in every country and all, and you've spent this time immersed in this marketplace, you're kind of at that edge where you're pulling back enough that you have some perspective, would you net out where you think search is going or what you think some of the hot upcoming trends are, or however you would filter an answer like that so that it would be valuable to my listeners and maybe something that would be actionable for them?
Sure. Well, I haven't been to every Google office, but I've been to quite a few.
Okay.
Like I said, I was pretty impressed with them. I think over the next few years, what we're going to see is a lot of convergence in terms of the media buying models that exist today. We see a lot of success with the auction-based model, and Google's achieved a formidable level of success with the auction-based model around the world. So I think a lot of that will start to come together. I think you'll start to be able to en masse buy your media in one or two locations or multiple locations using an auction-based model. And most of the folks that I talk to in media today are very interested in keeping an eye on this because that world is very dynamic and it's changing tremendously. Beyond that, keep an eye on Eastern Europe. I have plans to head over to Moscow if our new vice president doesn't start a war with Russia, praying that she doesn't get into that position. Not to go political, the debates are on tonight, the vice president debates. Nothing will guarantee McCain never being assassinated than having that vice president. But I'm watching what Yandex is doing in Russia. Y-A-N-D-E-X.
Okay, what's that?
It's Yandex is a big Russian search engine.
Oh.
And they're experiencing now Google-like growth year over year. The growth that we saw here in the United States in paid search from 2002 to like 2004, which was triple-digit growth year over year, it was the time when the search industry went from hundreds of millions to billions, seemingly overnight. So I'm keeping an eye on what's going on there. And along with the auction-based model, I think that's absolutely the future of what we're the future of media buying as we know it. Is going to be in that auction-based environment.
Okay, that's good to know. I'm thinking about, what was the auction company, Right Media, that Yahoo bought, where you can bid on media? So it's different than an ad network?
It's the moral equivalent of an ad network. The pricing model is auction-based.
Yeah, you see a trend there.
I see an enormous trend. I mean, people want accountability, and they are assigning value to everything that they buy in ways that they hadn't been before. Where we used to be immediately concerned with the CPM and backing that out to a conversion metric, we're now backing out the auction base and providing a range of what we can afford and what we can buy and what we can't buy. And that's forcing an absolute transmogrification of the analytics industry. And more people are investing. You know, we talk about vaguely what's happening with analytics and success measurement. There was a great study that was released earlier on this year that talked about what advertisers are going to be investing heavily in over the course of the next year. And overwhelmingly, what they talked about was a heavy investment in analytics. What we didn't see in that particular report and any of the reports that I've seen subsequent to that, yes, we know that people are going to be investing more in analytics, but we don't know exactly what they're going to be investing in. And my educated guess says that they're investing in trying to determine what the range of success metrics will be appropriate for them.
It's interesting. I just had dinner last night with Jim Stern. He's the chairman of the Web Analytics Association, better known as WAN. And you know Jim Stern, right?
Absolutely. Love
him. Isn't he just the best guy?
He really is. He's like a genuinely good guy in the business.
He is. And so I happened to be at the Web Video Conference yesterday, and he was at a conference that was concurrent with him. And I saw him across the room. I'm like, Jim! I go running in fake slow motion across the room, you know. So we ended up getting lucky enough to have dinner together. And we were talking about the web analytics. We were talking about the financial meltdown and the industry, and was it going to have a downturn? And Jim's wearing his little way button. And I said, so what do you think? And he said, well, I think we'll be the last ones to go down because when people tighten their belts, they care more about analytics. And we think we'll do very well. And we're in a growth spurt right now. And so it dovetails exactly what you were saying, Kevin.
Absolutely. Yeah. Oh, God, there's no money left. All right, we have to figure out how to better spend it.
That's, exactly.
I think the meltdown will only add napalm to the fire, so to speak, in terms of the growth that we're seeing in that area.
So what's your book about? You have a book? You've written books before. You're a writer. You've written for iMedia forever. Are you still writing for iMedia? I should know that.
I approached them with the concept of having a search desk editor long before search became popular. But I've been writing for, I wrote for iMedia for, I think, 5 years. When I came into Search Engine Watch, I started to write for Search Engine Watch as well.
Right, because that would have been competitive, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, maybe it is,
it's
hard to say.
It's all ego anyway.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's really hard to juggle multiple publications, and that's kind of what I'm doing now. But I had I've been approached by another author to write a book about the next generation of opportunity on the web. You know, there's a lot of people talking about how people have made money, and the first round or the first generation of .com millionaires. And I think we're approaching now what we would refer to as the more sane or second generation of that. So that's what the book is about. We're expecting to get it out right around December, January. One of the reasons that I moved out of Incisement into Motivity so that I could spend more time and actually finish the book.
Yeah.
And finish the first round of the book.
How's it feel to be writing again, writing a book?
Yeah, which is very different,
yeah,
by the way, than writing a weekly column.
Pulling
all
hard?
Those thoughts together is difficult.
Yeah. What do you do to focus yourself?
I eat a lot of mushrooms. I go to Amsterdam and consume massive quantities of mushrooms.
Mm-hmm.
And wherever I wake up, I just start typing.
That's good, because they have the freshest mushrooms in Amsterdam.
As I'm aware. Yes, mushrooms have been decriminalized in Amsterdam. By the way, if you want to write anything, the worst thing you could do, I think, is probably take any kind of drug.
Yeah. We know you were joking.
Yes, we hope so. I can see the quotes now in the thuggish anonymous blogs. Kevin Ryan says, do mushrooms. What I do is try to detach myself. It's very difficult to write in New York. You may have heard in the background there sirens going. I live about two blocks from Ground Zero, partially because I wanted to be here and watch them rebuild it, because I wasn't here when they came down.
Partially because you like to know when the sales really happen at J&R Electronics.
Oh, well, yeah, I live in the biggest electronics store in New York. So, yeah.
And you're a toy and gadget freak. We really know the answer. Bullshit. I'm calling bullshit on the Ground Zero thing. It's because you like the best price on your toys.
Well, you know, the funny thing, this is an interesting sidebar, but really stupid. Crossing, circumnavigating the globe, there's one thing that one store in New York City that people worldwide, Eastern Europe, Central Europe, Asia, know all about. I mean, in Bulgaria, they know this store. Mm-hmm. It's called Century 21. Discount store.
Yeah, discounted fashion.
So I can pretty much walk into any country around the world and say I live two blocks from Century 21, and everybody will know where that is. If I say I live two blocks from Ground Zero, they'll be like, nah, I'm not. So that's in Manhattan, right?
Well, it's we all love to shop, don't we?
Absolutely. So, I mean, to answer the original question, I tried to detach. What do you do to stimulate the creative juices?
Oh, yeah.
I try to get away from it. I get out of the city as much as I can.
Yeah.
I do some of my best writing when I'm flying.
Yeah.
I do some of my best writing after, 4 hours on a motorcycle.
That's my segue. Right there. This is how I want to end the show. You can say no if you don't want to do this, but here's what I want you to do. I want you, and I know you can because you're a writer, so I want you to evoke your visual mind, and I want you to put us on your motorcycle with you. I want you to tell us about your motorcycle, put us on there, drive us out of the city and into the country, and right out of the show. Will you do it?
Speaking of taking mushrooms... sure.
Okay, we're ready. I'm just going to sit back and relax, and you're going to just take us right out of the show. We're ready. Take us on a trip.
You have to control your breathing. You have to be very aware of your surroundings. The background on the bike is that it's a German bike. It's right out of Bavaria. It was a very limited production BMW R12, which was their cruiser model. They made, 400 of them. And I bought it accidentally on September 4th, 2001. And it's black. There's not a lot of chrome. Not a big chrome guy. I'm not into shiny things. And riding gives you a level of freedom, and it's very difficult to describe to anybody that hasn't done it. But I'll give it a whirl. You don't think about anything other than staying alive and enjoying the environment around you. And you experience it in ways that you could never do riding around in a cage. You smell everything. You see and hear everything. Over the noise of the bike, the world around you, you become very aware of just how fragile you are. You become very aware of everything around you. The sights, the smells, everything, it's all there and it's in your face. So for those of us with overactive brains who spend a lot of time thinking, who have the type of overachieving imagination or overachieving mentality that often precludes us from being able to just sit back, take a step back and think, riding actually allows you to do that, and it allows you to do it in a way that you can clear your mind, that you can become far more aware of your own mortality and the things that are around you in ways that you just can't imagine. And that, for me, is pretty much the riding experience. That's why I love it so much. That's why I wish I could do it more. That's why I'll probably end up back in California in the not-so-distant future so that I can spend some more time riding.
Nice. And you ride out of Manhattan and up into the countryside in New York?
Well, I actually have the bike permanently stored in upstate New York and in the wine country region. So I pile my very large, hairy child, which is a 7-year-old German Shepherd, into my mom car, and I drive up, and then I can pick up the bike and go riding. I ride around the Finger Lakes region, which is a very, very beautiful part of New York.
Beautiful time to go there now with the fall leaves changing, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Just wear that winter coat.
Nice. Well, we have a welcome mat out in the state of California for you, Kevin Ryan. Want you to come back home anytime you can. And thanks so much for being on the show today. Good luck getting the book done. I know it is no small feat, but you have what it takes to do it. And we can't wait to hear your opinions about that and anything else you want to write about. So Congrats on the change back to Motivity. I'm sure it's going to be freeing and expanding for you in so many ways. So keep us up to date with what you're doing.
Sure, absolutely. And thanks for having me.
Oh, yeah. You know it's my pleasure. Always my pleasure. Last little bit. Don't forget the swag. I want to give you some goodies. So go post what you'd like to have and let me give it to you. And also, Tim made me a really nice URL. You know how I'm always asking you to take my Dishy Mix listener survey so I know more about your opinions and get some demographic information from my sponsors? Well, it was always hard to find my survey. So Tim made me a URL. It's survey.personallifemedia.com. And if you can remember that one, it'll take you right to the survey. It's anonymous. It takes less than 5 minutes. It's like, I don't know, 5 or 10 questions, something really simple. And it helps me. And I know you want to do that. So thank you so much. I am your host, Susan Bratton. Have a great day.
Find more great shows like this on personallifemedia.com.